You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, before we get going, I want to tell you about our sponsor and a service that I am a fan of, Mubi. I get Mubi on my Apple TV. You can stream it just about anywhere. It's a curated online cinema that streams exceptional films from around the globe. They got documentaries, stuff from festivals, classics. I saw a Jean-Pierre Melville retrospective. I always look forward to the email telling me what's new. They introduce one movie. It's a handpicked gem every day, and you have 1 month to watch it. It is that simple. Give it a try. Mubi, Mubi.com/longform gets you Mubi free for 30 days, and you'll be supporting the show. Thank you, Mubi. Here's the show. Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. They are my co-hosts.
Joyous occasion.
My pilots, my here co-pilots. Great show for you today. I talked to Michael Idoff, who I've been trying to get on the show for, I can tell you, literally 5 years, because I looked back on emails. And the reason I was originally trying to get him on the show, which is still why I was trying to get him on the show, is he wrote this incredible story.
Movie set that ate itself.
The movie set that ate itself, about this like belabored production of a movie that this Russian director, who I really liked his first movie, and they build a whole town, and they spent, like, I think it's already the most expensive movie in Russian history. And I emailed him in 2013 being like, when's that movie coming out? Movie has still not come out.
Whoa.
Still being worked on.
I think that that article might have garnered the biggest physical reaction in you of anything I've ever watched you read.
I love that article.
You're just like hooting, hollering, slamming desks. You had such a good time reading that piece.
So Michael was a kind of like a music critic around New York, writing art stuff, and then started doing features. He's written features for GQ. He was at New York Magazine for a while. And then he got hired through a really weird series of events as the editor-in-chief of GQ Russia, moved his family to Moscow, had some pretty strange experiences, and he wrote a book about that that's out now. It's called Dressed Up for a Riot. We talked about that, what it's like to edit a magazine in Russia, and what he's up to now.
It's a good one.
Oh, man. I'm excited for this one. Was it rollicking?
I would say it was pretty rollicking. It was about as rollicking as I get before noon. If you've got rollicking good news to share with the people in your life, send it out with an email newsletter. It's the thing that people actually read, and the best way to do it is with MailChimp. They support this show, so you should support them. Thank you, MailChimp.
And now here's Aaron with Michael Idoff.
Welcome, Michael Idoff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What brings you to town now? I know that you're not, I just read your book, so I know that you don't live in New York City anymore.
Well, actually, the book brings me to town because it's coming out next month.
Yeah.
And I came here to record the audiobook of it, which was made for a really surreal trip to New York, because I've been basically ensconced in this phone booth of a recording studio, just sitting, you know, in a room with padded walls, reading my own book out loud, which is sort of what madness is like, right?
Yeah. So the book,
yeah.
Dressed Up for a Riot, covers pretty much like right around when street protests were breaking out in Moscow, and you went there to become the head of GQ Russia. So catch me up on what's happened since the book. What are you up to now?
Right. Well, you know, after sort of largely failing to put out a good magazine in Russia, and part of the failing was, you know, me, and part of it was circumstances, and I basically moved on to my sort of the actual thing I went to school for, my actual calling and forte, which is screenwriting, and I've been doing that ever since, about 2015, and I've been living in Berlin since 2015 also, so that's where I'm at, so living in Berlin and writing movies and TV shows.
It seems like each of these things is like comes off of the last thing in a somewhat unlikely manner. So going back to the period of your life before you emigrated to America, where did your ambitions as a writer start?
I mean, this is going to sound cheesy, but I knew by the age of like six that I wanted to be a writer, right after a very brief period of wanting to be a paleontologist when I was like five. So the paleontologist dream was gone by six, and that's it. That's basically, since then, I've been involved in some kind of storytelling, you know?
I usually don't ask people on the show about their like early childhood, but one of the notable things in your book is that two of your friends from childhood went on to be successful, like best-selling writing duo.
Yeah.
Was that like a competitive pursuit with you and them?
Like, we've always been crazy competitive. And there were three of us, like three guys in like a class that was otherwise all female. So in Russia, you know, they don't shuffle classes.
You're with the same people.
The same people, like first grade to like 12th grade, right?
Yeah.
So we went, basically, we just kind of educated ourselves together. We would swap books and cassette tapes and just discuss everything and just kind of be like a unit.
What were you reading as a trio? What was the...
You know, the Russian classics, like they drilled them into you way too early and still do. Like, you're not supposed to understand what Anna Karenina is about in eighth grade. It's ridiculous, you know? It's like, I'm 41 now, and I feel like maybe the last two or three years of my life, like, I have amassed enough experience to reread Anna Karenina and to actually, like, get the sophistication of, like, the multiple points of view that it has. You know, so instead of, like, the great Russian classics, which we were supposed to learn, we've been reading a lot of, like, Samizdat, which just then the Russian press started publishing some things that had been suppressed before. So we've been reading a lot of Bulgakov. We've been huge fans of Vasily Aksenov as well. Anthony Burgess was like a huge favorite of mine at that point, and it just started showing up in Russian. Anyway, so yeah, we were reading a lot of that, but mostly we were like listening to just metric tons of like rock and roll music, obviously, and you know, new wave and all that.
To go from that background, and I hate that I'm doing this because you basically read in the book about how you like do not like being sort of pigeonholed as a recent immigrant writer. But coming from that experience, what was it like coming to America and trying to write in English?
Right. Well, it's funny because when we were immigrating into the U.S. in 1992, I had just published in Latvia my first sci-fi story, actually. I was 16 years old. I just had my first publication.
That's impressive. Yeah, I thought about doing that, but it never left.
No, it was like a teen thing. I have never like written sci-fi since, but that thing was published in like a Sunday edition of the local paper, and of course, in my mind, when we were going to the States, like I was leaving behind a brilliant literary career, you know?
Yeah.
So I threw all these fits to my parents. I was like, you are depriving me of the language. Like you are, you know, cutting me off at the roots. I will never be anything because, you know, back then, you know, you didn't realize that in five more years you would be on email and like on ICQ with the same people you were friends with.
Yeah.
Because we were like right on the cusp of the internet era when we were leaving, but it's still like my friends and I exchanged like actual written letters. You know, we spent fortunes on them in like 93, 94. But anyway, no, of course it was a culture shock, but you know what? It's like, look, I went from a fairly sort of intellectual milieu to like being like a super poor kid on food stamps in like a really kind of hard, like working class neighborhood of Cleveland, Ohio. So the class-based culture shock, it's actually more significant, I think, than the actual like going from one country to another. Just like when I moved from New York to Moscow, you know, to edit GQ in 2012, everyone in Moscow, like every interview I gave there, people were asking me, so what does it feel like to be back? And, you know, and I said that, you know, actually today's Moscow and today's New York, they are less dissimilar than the Latvia that I left in today's Moscow. So it's actually not that big a deal now. It's like the biggest change is always, I think, in time, not in space. <you know? laughs>
What were your first attempts to break into writing or to do stuff?
So I came to the States in the summer of 92. About September of 93, I went to Cleveland State University. And I immediately started writing for the local, like the student paper. It was called The Cauldron. So a year into being in the United States, I was already like writing really bad film reviews for The Cauldron. And then I went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and I immediately started writing for the Michigan Daily, which was like a, you know, a more reputable student paper that actually at times felt like working for like a real paper. So yeah, I started, you know, with film reviews because back then I sort of entertained the idea of becoming like a film critic when I, you know, grow up. And then I started writing plays because my sort of thinking went that my English was not enough for quality prose, but it was just sufficient for mimicking dialogue. And that's all you have to do. You know, everything else is not as language dependent. So I graduated with just a bunch of theater plays and a bunch of film reviews. So I went to New York and I really had no idea where to, like, where and to whom to show my theater stuff. And I was not a theater kid. Like, I was, you know, I actually enjoyed plays more as written. Like, I would go to the library and read, like, David Mamet or something. Like, I never actually wanted to like go to the theater and see it.
Like, it was, I feel like you're the only person who's like not a theater kid I've ever heard of like writing. Like among people I know, like theater is such a like a all-encompassing like pursuit as like a teenager that like the only people I know who ever were trying to write plays were like lived and breathed theater.
God, no. I actually kind of dislike theater because first of all, I was always like afraid of actors and I could never understand them like as human beings.
I'm with you.
Right. So yeah, so I had my favorites. Like I really, really adore David Herson as the playwright, for example, but I only saw one of his plays on stage. And again, I just like reading his plays. So yes, I'm weird that way. Anyway, so yeah, I didn't know what to do theater wise and I just started showing my film clips around and Then next thing I knew, I was interning at the Village Voice and writing little things for them. And then it was like a pretty straight progression kind of up the usual like New York journalism ladder with some weird detours.
How did you get your first few magazine features? When did you start doing like stuff at that length?
Well, I was pretty shrewd about it, actually, when I really started getting into it, because what I would do is I would get tiny little items into sort of things that you could get tiny little items in and then use these items as pitches for larger stories in larger publications. And I would kind of like try to game this out from the beginning. Like I would write a free blurb for Pitchfork and then I would use the Pitchfork blurb that already looks like more legitimate instead of like a cold pitch to Slate. I will give them like the Pitchfork thing and say, I can expand on this. And then like if Slate takes it, then like I can, you know, parlay that into something else. So that was basically the game.
What kind of stuff were you trying to mostly pitch up the ladder that way?
Mostly music reviews at that point. Film and music reviews. Yeah. I still thought of myself as primarily like a pop culture critic. At that point. But then slowly but surely it kind of mutated into kind of all-purpose journalism. My big break, I don't know, I feel silly to use these words, but my big break was in fact a Slate story in late 2005. And it just goes to show that the best thing you can possibly do as a journalist is to forget you're a journalist, go out, have some authentic experiences, preferably like fail at something really hard, and then write about that, because that's what resonated.
Which story was that?
Well, it was called Bitter Brew, and it was a first-person essay about trying to like run a coffee house that my wife and I co-owned very briefly on the Lower East Side. And it was just a funny 1,200-word piece for Slate. It was kind of evergreen because it had no news bag to it, so they held on to it for a couple of months. And then they published it, I remember, on December 30th of 2005. And I thought, all right, well, no one's going to read it. Like, everyone's
they
just
must really believe in it.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, whoa, that's, yeah. And then on New Year's Day, like, I wake up and I look at my email inbox. This was back when you checked email once a day. And there's hundreds of emails in it, because it just really resonated with people. Like, this just kind of funny sort of self-deprecating story about like trying to run a coffee house and failing and like fighting with your wife as a result. And I was buried under an avalanche of similar stories by people who were just reminiscing about their own failed business ventures. And then, you know, hidden among those emails was an email from the late, great Nora Ephron, who read the story and wrote to me saying, I think this will make a great book or maybe even a charming little movie. Let me introduce you to my agent. Her agent was Amanda Binky Urban, one of the sort of most famous and best agents in the world. And a few other agents called me after the story, and everyone wanted me to do like a nonfiction, kind of like a business self-help book out of it, which I was really not interested in. So, and I kept saying, like, well,
that's like a funny alternate like timeline of your life where you wrote a self-help book about it and now you're like a like successful self-help author.
Oh yeah, I'd be probably like much, you know, wealthier, but I think it would be, I would be really miserable. But anyway, so I would just tell them, like, look, I don't want to do a self-help book, you know, or a business advice book, God forbid, but, like, I will, if you want, I can totally do it as a novel, like, as a satirical novel.
Yeah.
At this point, everyone just went, like, click, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, I was like, okay, a satirical novel, great, bye-bye.
And right. As you were telling them that you could do a satirical novel, like, had you published fiction at this point? Or was this all just kind of, like, on spec?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, look, like, what I really want to do is tell stories, like, unencumbered by, like, what actually happened. So, I want to do this as a novel. And Binky Urban was the only one to not hang up on me immediately. And she was like, all right, well, are you aware of the fact that you will probably get like 10 to 50 times less money for this as a novel? And I was like, but still, like, and I did do this as a novel.
Yeah.
And she sold it and got published as Ground Up. It came out in 2009. It did okay, but nothing spectacular in the States. And here is where the story gets really crazy, because my wife Lily and I translated it into Russian, pretty much just for bragging rights, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, did you get paid for that, or were you just like...
Peanuts. Yeah. But I just wanted to be able to say that I'm the only guy since Nabokov to write something in English and translated myself into Russian.
I was
going to
say, two things that people have consistently told me take way longer than they thought were recording the audiobook of their book and translating their
own
book.
I can now, you know, I can confirm both. So yeah, it took like half a year to translate it, and it was excruciating because Russian was still sort of my native language.
Yeah, I was going to say, were you like confident in like your Russian translation?
Really not confident at all. Yeah, I was very scared because, I mean, it was grammatically correct, but like, you know, you still have to be in the context. You have to, like, know the latest memes, know the latest slang, especially when you're writing about, like, relatively young people who are, like, basically, like, hipsters in a sort of, you know, in a modern, like, urban situation. So, yeah, and then something really ridiculous happened, that translation of it. It became a huge bestseller in Russia, and that basically preordained the rest of everything that happened to me, because then I won like writer of the year at the Russian GQ Awards, and then that slowly but surely like led to me taking over the Russian GQ, etc. So basically I can trace my entire life to that one article for Slate in 2005.
Okay, so I won't make you explain the entire chain of events that went from you having a middlingly successful American novel to you becoming the editor of GQ Russian. Pretty rapid fire sequence of events, but it's in the book. It's very entertaining. When you sat down that first day and arrived and were like, okay, and now I'm the editor of GQ, like, what was your plan? What, like, did you have a vision for what you should be in the media world of Moscow 2012?
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty cocky in terms of what I thought I would be able to do with the magazine, you know. At that point, I had been working at New York Magazine for 6 years as a contributing editor, and I was also freelancing at American GQ.
New Republic, and GQ.
Yeah, but you know, so my kind of biggest influences in terms of editing were, in fact, you know, Adam Moss's New York and Jim Nelson's GQ. So those were the people whose ideas I tried to kind of bring to Russia, you know. Adam Moss's famous kind of package approach, when you take a topic, and it can be a mundane or almost a random topic like breakfast or circumcision, and you just attack it from like 5, 6, 7 angles. You do an essay, listicle, a photo essay, etc., and you just kind of gloriously like exhaust this topic so that your competition will feel silly even broaching the subject for the next 5 years because you've said everything there could be you could possibly say on the subject. So I always loved that approach, and Jim Nelson's kind of relentless search of the service component and everything, like in a good way, you know. It's like, what do I as a reader get out of this? Like, what is the takeaway? What is the use? What's new? So yeah, that those were the things that were really in my head when I headed over to Russia to do this, because the Russian publishing or the Russian magazine world is not that dissimilar from like French. It's very column based, so lots of just public intellectuals kind of bloviating on whatever topic strikes their fancy, and they have their own, you know, name columns. So a magazine would be like half of the magazine would just be personal essays. Running virtually unedited, and then the other half would be like Q&As, you know, and they would barely do sort of the American profile type thing where you fold the quotes into the body of the article. They'll just do a straight Q&A with an intro, you know. That's more of a European kind of way of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of experience of like what you had been doing, at least the stuff I've read, I know you've like done lots of stuff, but like I first encountered your work, like the profile you wrote of this Russian film director who had built this entire set that was a town that was also a set and a town, I guess. And you profiled the richest man in Georgia. Does that stuff really exist in like a Russia GQ, like a big profile feature that's not like a Q&A, but is like the writer kind of giving you their take and their sort of first person experience?
Well, that, it existed when I was there.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like when you're trying to hire for something like that, and that like format doesn't exist, are you like trying to import writers, or how do you tackle it?
No, well, I did import a couple of writers. I was very happy to work with Julia Yaffe, who's you know, a friend, and we kind of started out together. So she actually did a great profile of the American ambassador at the time, Michael McFaul, for my GQ that then I think a version of it ran in like, you know, an American magazine, I think the New Republic or Foreign Policy. And yeah, and I did the same things myself. Like I was a writing editor, you know, I did that profile of Bidzina Ivanishvili, the, you know, the richest man in Georgia who was running for prime minister at the time. I did it for the Russian GQ, and then the New Republic published it as well. So yeah, so I was lucky enough to be able to do that. So obviously I was trying to present myself as like a David Remnick-like figure of just like, I would need like 3 weeks a year to like go off and do my own, you know.
You're going to write a book on the side at night.
Right. Exactly. I don't know how he does it. But anyway, so I met with a lot of skepticism, of course. A lot of my Russian friends were saying like, oh, you will never find good writers here. Yeah. You will spend like your entire time just trying to explain to people how it works. But honestly, I found a group of fantastic writers. And I think one of my maybe sort of legacies after I left the Russian GQ is that almost everyone I've worked with at GQ Russia are still writing and doing an amazing job as long-form journalists in Russia.
Yeah. I noticed kind of a like in rereading through your archive of long form magazine features, a lot of them, I mean, that experiential element is pretty common. And like in the case of that film story and the story about the richest man in Georgia, you're kind of like put in this situation where your role and like welcomeness in the place where you're supposed to be reporting is like kind of unstable. I'm curious, like, how you navigate situations like that. Like, what were your first big stories where you were out reporting and doing profiles like?
Well, I think the Dow story, the one about Ilya Khrushchevsky, the yeah. sort of the mad film director who's still doing post-production on that film,
by the way,
8 years later.
I have been following that story for a very long time. So the story, I actually saw his first movie, Four. I had a friend who was like working, I feel like, the box office at the Tribeca film festival. I could be wrong about one film festival. And he was like, yo, there's one movie played that was fucking insane. You should try and get this movie. At the time, I was really deep in like torrenting international movies that were like out somewhere else, but not in America. So I found a torrent. It had already come out in Russia, I think. So I got a torrent of it. And I watched it. And I was just like, I mean, for anyone listening, I think it may actually be on Netflix now.
Could very well be.
The movie is titled Four. And so you wrote this profile, the director making his second movie, in which he had already burnt untold sums of money, constructed an entire town, had an entire cast of people basically living in this town as actor slash, I mean, as a job, basically.
Right.
So, like, describe for me, like, dropping into that situation as a reporter.
Well, I was definitely in kind of a weak position because basically sort of access to the set meant playing by his rules.
Yeah.
And that meant just kind of like stripping off everything, you know, literally stripping off everything because on the set, it was the year 1956 or whatever. Right. And so you had to wear period clothes down to the underwear in order to gain access. And of course, there was this weird subjective element of it. It's like, how much of this is a performance? You know, like, is this guy programming what I will write by like having all, like, basically contriving all these things to happen, like having a young woman like playing a waitress at a Soviet grocery store, like, come and like hit on me and things like that, you know?
And there's a slight element the story evokes, and I don't know if this is like an intention on your part, where you also start to wonder the experience that all of these people who are acting in this movie, like, you feel like you're getting fucked with, but potentially they're also getting fucked with by other
in
actors.
Major
like,
ways.
The fuckery kind of goes every way.
Because
in the
he's
story.
Because he's created a totalitarian society where you survive by snitching on other people. And then that's when I realized that although I'm actually, despite what you said, I'm not actually a huge fan of inserting myself as a character into magazine stories. But here I realized that the only way to tell the story is to basically chronicle what being back in a way in a totalitarian society, albeit a really small one, is doing to me and how it's turning me into a snitch, you know? Yeah. And so that's why the culmination of the story is me like ratting out my own photographer so that he can get thrown out from the set so I get to stay, which is like basically the logical end result of being in this sort of totalitarian mindfuck situation. But honestly, one aside is that I'm very curious to see how in the sort of post-Harvey Weinstein moment this movie will fair, because if you go back to my story and actually if you re-interview, you know, people who've worked on the movie, that film, the circumstance of creating this film has been one like horrendous sexual harassment fest, you know, because part of sort of Khrushchevsky's entire raison d'etre is exercising control to the extent of like sometimes mental torture and really, really nasty manipulation of young women. That's a really disturbing side of that that movie. So I think that, you know, the movie will come out eventually in one form or another, but before anyone celebrates it too hard, they should probably also look at completely obvious abuse and harassment that actually like permeated the entire set.
What's the status of the movie now? I mean, part of what's kind of powerful about the story is you feel like you're reading like an oral history of Apocalypse Now or something, except without having seen Apocalypse Now. Like the fact that you can't see the movie makes the images that you evoke in the story seem like very viscerally real.
Well, thank you. Right. I was on set in 2010. The story ran in 2011. I believe by the end of 2011, beginning of 2012, they finally finished filming, and they celebrated by burning down the set, which they've lived on for like 4 years at the time, at that moment. And then since then, Krzyżanowski has been sitting in London, continuing to be lavishly funded by this insane Russian oligarch who keeps giving him like tens of millions of dollars to continue this charade and quote-unquote editing the movie. So
what do you think is really happening?
Well, the movie does exist, and there's, if anything, there's too much of it. There's like 10 movies. So they've been talking about maybe releasing it as like an immersive experience with like a live element, or maybe building theaters like that are going to be like temples of Tao, which would show all these movies on like a 24-hour cycle. And that would be like site-specific sort of things that like in the major cities of the world, anyone could come in and watch Tao. And then in October of 2017, something like this was in fact supposed to happen in Berlin. They rented out like almost like a city block of Berlin and started hiring like all the circus performers, and I think they were trying to hire a bunch of psychiatrists because they had this harebrained idea that after watching the movie, every person who watches the movie needs to have like a debriefing in front of a psychiatrist, and just more and more kind of madness. But basically what they're doing now, at this point, it's by far the most expensive Russian movie ever made. Yeah. I think the budget is around like $70 million at this point. So I think what Krzyżanowski is rather shrewdly trying to do is to move the whole thing from the realm of movie making, where it will never make its money back and the oligarch bankrolling it might have some questions about like where the hell his money went, into the realm of modern art, kind of like a huge, like immersive modern art experience, including like performances by Marina Abramovic and songs by like Russian songwriters, et cetera, so that at least in the realm of modern art, it's not unusual to pay $70 million for something that just kind of hangs on your wall or just exists out there, you know? So in that sense, you know, the main sponsor of the movie ends up with like a giant artwork on his hands,
right,
as opposed to just a crazy long movie that will maybe play some festivals.
When you write a story like that, and that story is really like kind of the only thing you can find about it online,
I know Krzyżanowski really must hate that.
I know that because I googled it this morning, because I was like, has that movie come out? Nope, still hasn't come out. Like, does it stick with you? Like, you're kind of still a part of that story?
I try to follow what's happening with the movie, and I have my spies in the world of the movie, so that's why I knew about this like botched Berlin premiere in October.
Director is not happy with you in the end, though.
No, not at all. No, I think he's got to be very unhappy with me. And because obviously the image and the story and the narrative that I am delivering to the world is clearly not the narrative that he wanted me to broadcast by bringing me onto the set. So, but hey, that's fine. No, I mean, I'm just very proud of that story. Like, I don't like a couple of turns of phrase I thrown into that story, but otherwise I think it's probably the most accomplished magazine story that I've done in my memory. So.
Are you inclined to go back to like magazine feature writing as something you would do in the future? Or are you, I mean, you've already done like three things at a pretty high level, like writing nonfiction, editing a magazine, and now screenwriting.
Right. Well, it's hard. Like over the last 2 years, I've done two magazine stories, and both were pretty much just autobiographical.
I've done
like a thing for New York Times Magazine, basically about being a Russian screenwriter.
Yeah.
And I've done a story for New York Magazine early in 2017 about this idea of like the lack of trust in institutions in Russia and how we should watch out for that in Trump era America. So I probably wouldn't be able to do this full time again, because it's just once you start working in movies, it's a drug you can't really quit.
Yeah.
But obviously I love the magazine long story format, and you know that if I can afford to work in it, I will. You know,
how did you start screenwriting in Russia, and what's it like? You know, oh, I'm already an experienced feature writer, but now I'm doing something that I'm like kind of starting at zero again with.
Well, it's not really fair because that's what I actually went to school for. So true, it was true. More like, you know, it more was more like something I was just like sitting on and not using for years. And then being in Russia just kind of gave me like the impetus to do this because I was actually so kind of depressed at the GQ job in Russia that I needed something just kind of for myself. So I started writing kind of on spec and then started showing.
What depressed you about the GQ job?
Oh, the political situation, the fact that like my efforts to create a quality magazine, you know, met little to no appreciation from the very people I tried to reach, like the anti-Putin kind of opposition crowd that I basically came to Russia in a way to describe, but also to join in a way, you know, that basically a lot of them just turned out to just be unbelievable assholes to me for basically just coming to Russia, because there's that amazing self-hatred that a lot of progressive Russians feel for anything Russian. So the same people who would kind of look up to me when I was at New York Magazine, as soon as I would like cross over and come to Moscow and take a Moscow job, the very fact of me coming to their country, to them, was selling out. I know it sounds absurd, but that's how they think. It's just like, so you went to Russia. This must be only for money, because for what earthly reason could you, like, would you leave a job in the United States and come to our, to borrow a word from our president, shithole country, you know? But that's how they feel. And so this bizarre Russophobia of the actual Russians that I dealt with was just a completely impenetrable obstacle to trying to reach them.
Was that like socially isolating for you, or was that also make it like hard to do your job as a magazine editor?
Both, of course, because the people I considered my friends before I came to Russia, a lot of them would like not have anything to do with me because they thought I had sold out to like the soulless world of high gloss glamour, because that's how they perceived GQ. And I didn't even realize that.
But they wouldn't have thought that if you were like working at GQ America.
No, not at all. No. But because they would tend to like romanticize all American magazines, but like the Russian GQ, they couldn't even perceive it as like an international magazine, as a Condé Nast magazine. They perceived it as like a place where good writers can go like bang out articles that no one back in the scene reads and make a quick buck, because we despise what that publishing house stands for, but will still take their money. So, but now you're like, you know, you're in there, and like all we see is like your Instagram from like the Milan Fashion Week. And I was like, well, yeah, but that's what I have to do as part of the job. I can't just do half of my job, you know? And so I couldn't get over that idea that for a lot of progressive westernized Russians, the magazine I ended up heading up, no matter what I would do with it, the very fact of me working for that magazine would brand me as kind of vaguely pro-status quo and possibly even pro-Putin,
right,
just for sort of for taking the dirty money, you know.
So if you had come to Russia as a freelance writer or, you know, with a contract to write features for Vanity Fair about Russia or something like that, it would have been a totally different experience.
Yeah, of course. And I had done that before, because I would come to Russia to do stories for the New Republic and for New York Magazine. And, you know, they loved that. But as soon as you take a job in Russia, I was like, oh, you're just as much of a piece of shit as the rest of us.
Yeah. You know? And so you got depressed and thought,
I was as miserable as I had ever been in my life.
And you had your whole family there, so
I had dragged my wife and like 1 year old kid there. And also, one thing I was not prepared for was that, you know, in Russia, editors in chief of magazines are kind of B-list celebrities.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously in the States we have like our, you know, Graydon Carter and Anna Wintour.
Yeah.
But they're like basically every man is a Graydon Carter and every woman is Anna Wintour. So there's just an insane amount of like media and public attention on you, and it's just not, I mean, I'm not trying to sound cute, but like it's really not me. Like I'm as vain as the next guy. Like I like my work to be known, but I really hate for my face to be known. Like I don't like playing that whole thing of like going to parties and being photographed.
Yeah.
Especially just the extent to which a lot of it was basically just performed for the advertiser's sake. You know, like I had a watch advertiser pull their ads because I was too sick to come to a concert that they were sponsoring. Like I was supposed to come and like be photographed at their logo well, and I didn't. Right. And they pulled their goddamn ad. And it's like, that was the first time I realized that I'm in some sort of bizarre world. You
right.
know?
Which is in itself kind of a wacky world version of like the American Hollywood red carpet, like take your picture in front of a bunch of like ad logos. Like
Right. And in Russia, that's their high society, you know, yeah. like whereas in America, like the real high society would be like museum benefit and kind of like charity based.
Yes.
There, like they don't do that. So most of what they do is like freaking product launches, you know, like right. that's where like they go to a party for the launch of the new model of like BMW and all get photographed there. And then you have to be there because they're one of your biggest advertisers. Yeah. And then all the other people see, you know, the people you're actually trying to reach see is like you surrounded by all these like Botoxed men and women. You have no idea what you're doing there, and your friends and former friends have no idea what game you're playing. And you're just trying to put out a magazine, you know.
What kind of exit plans did you start to formulate after you realized that this is what your life would be like as long as you were the editor of GQ Russia?
I mean, they had always known that I was going to do this for either 2 or 3 years. Like when they offered me the job, I guaranteed 2 years because otherwise like it wouldn't be worth it for them to bring me over. But the only question was 2 or 3.
Yeah.
It ended up being like 2.5. So the simplest exit plan was just coming back to the U.S.
Yeah.
But then the movie thing happened because I started writing these scripts as therapy, really, just writing them on spec. Like my friend and I wrote this autobiographical sitcom pilot, literally about an American writer getting stuck in Moscow and being tempted with all these crazy, you know, enticements of the glamorous Moscow and like basically just kind of becoming a terrible person as a result. And I had no illusions that this could ever be seen by anyone. But then I showed it to a couple of people, and that's kind of the great thing about Russia is like just things get done there. They get done badly, but they do get done because they're so starved for kind of fresh voices and you know, fresh talent. And so it's not about me being great. It's about basically them just being like really stagnant culturally, because the moment I showed this script around, like, 2 weeks later, it had one of Russia's biggest actors and producers attached to it. And then they shot the pilot, and then they ordered the entire series. And that's when I knew that I probably have to, you know, quit GQ then and then and devote myself to it. Then, of course, the ruble fell and the TV network changed heads and they canceled the series, but I still got the pilot out of it.
Can you talk about what you're writing now screenplay-wise, or is it secret?
I have directed my first movie. That's a Russian movie, and it's in Russian, but it was shot in Latvia, and it's co-produced by Russia, Latvia, and the Czech Republic. So I'm editing it in Prague now, and it should be ready by the summer. And I'm writing an American TV pilot for TNT.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Long Form Podcast. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer. Thanks to our intern, Angela Velez. Thanks to our incredible sponsors, MailChimp and Mubi. Give Mubi a chance if you are sick of all the algorithms feeding you stuff you don't want. I get Mubi on my Apple TV. Each day they introduce a new handpicked gem of a movie, whether it's a classic, a documentary, something from a festival, and you have 1 month to watch it. It's simply a better way to find something to watch and will save you the great emotional pain of sitting with your loved ones and trying to figure out something to watch. I really recommend it. You can try it today, free for 30 days by going to mubi.com/longform. Thanks, Mubi. We will see you next week. If you want to get in touch, you can send us an email, editors@longform.org. We're always looking for feedback. We're always looking for sponsors. And we are always looking to hear from you, the listener, about who you'd like to hear on the show. Okay, see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.